Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to New Books in Dance. I'm your host, Sitara Thavani. Today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Halifu Osamare, the author of Dancing in Blackness. Combining memoir with autoethnography, historical study, and sociocultural analysis, Dr. Osamare draws on her decades of experience to explore the complexities of Black dance in the United States. So doing, she underscores the relationship between art, performance, and Black struggles for recognition, justice, and self-empowerment. Thank you so much, Dr. Osamare, for taking the time to speak with us, especially in the middle of your book tour. Congratulations on your memoir. It's a wonderful read and a very full life that you're telling us about.
Well, thank you, Sitara. I'm glad to be a part of the New Books in Dance series.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. To begin, could you tell us how you came to writing this memoir at this point?
Well, I have recently retired, so I'm Professor Emerita of African American and African Studies at University of California, Davis. So obviously when you retire, you have a lot more time to put into your research and your writing. But I had started this memoir about a year before I retired in July of 2016. So it was always on my research agenda to use my own life to explore issues of my dance career in relationship to the development of Black dance in the United States and really globally. Finally, retiring allowed me the time to really focus, finish the manuscript, and submit it for publication to University Press of Florida.
Okay. And that's something that really comes out in your writing is you talk about how you're writing both as a dancer and as a scholar. Could you reflect a little bit on the intersections between those two different aspects of your different kinds of work?
Well, I was a dancer. I started, I would say, professionally in 1968 and continued all the way up until approximately 2005, where I was performing and actually teaching either in community studios or in university dance departments. It's when I finally went to University of California, Davis, my last position, that I let go of the actual artist performing part of myself and made a transition into being completely an academic and a scholar. However, when I went into the classroom, I always took my idea of performance and engaging the students from that sense of being a performer. And I usually was very successful because I always felt like I was in some ways, choreographing my class. I was doing a kind of dance in my lecture that might not have been physical, but it was a way of looking at teaching as performance. And so I found the intersections between those two very stimulating, both for myself and for my students. And many times when I would tell my students that I was a former dancer, professional dancer, choreographer, that really impressed them that I was more than just a thinker, but I actually was a doer in the world. And usually that got their attention by mentioning my previous career. So I found various ways of those intersections. And in the book, I talk about the idea of writing as a way of dancing, like dancing on the page. And when I would write, I would always feel like I was also doing a kind of dance with words.
That's quite striking to me. That relationship then between dance and words, that relationship between dance and discourse, is that something that you enjoy bringing together? Are there any tensions in that relationship that I've heard that other dancers might not embrace that relationship so much?
Well, for me, there's never been a tension between the two because I always felt that when I was moving, I was non-verbally articulating. And I looked at dance not just only as movement, but as unspoken text. And so it was very easy for me to find the intersections between those two media. And I had worked with a poet and playwright who became very famous early in the 70s in the San Francisco, Oakland Bay Area, Entezake Shange, the author of For Colored Girls Who Consider Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough, that, you know, became a Broadway production. But the poems that were the basis of that particular play were developed in the Bay Area when she and I became friends in around 1973. And there is a chapter in the book that explores that relationship. So I used to do dance improvs to her poetry when she would give public presentations of her poetry that eventually became the poems that were coalesced into For Colored Girls. And I was always exploring with other artists the way that the word and movement meshed and enhanced each other. So I've never felt a tension or a conflict between the two. But in fact, I felt like they really spoke to each other and that nonverbal movement expression actually enhanced the spoken word and vice versa, that the spoken word enhanced the nonverbal movement.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to delve right into your book. You speak about how dance is, for you, a form of revolutionary expression, which I found to be very striking, and also allowing you to explore the many dimensions of Blackness, be that social, cultural, political, historical. Could you speak about that as an entry point then?
Well, when I named the book Dancing in Blackness, oftentimes people want me to find what I mean by Blackness. And as you have read the book and as people have looked at the way in which I developed my career, it is very much from two basic aspects. First, a kind of celebratory way of invoking an ancestral legacy that is African, that has its roots in African-based dance forms. I call it Africanist because I don't always have to be doing what is considered traditional African dance. I can do movement that has that legacy and that impetus as a part of it. And I think my entire career has kind of centered around that invoking of that legacy and how that legacy has continued to morph and shift in new ways as, you know, the decades went on. And my production that I mentioned throughout the book that continued to develop as I developed as an artist, the evolution of Black dance really kind of invoked that legacy. And I think the other aspect of how I am looking at dance in relationship to Blackness has to do with dance as a tool of social political change. And so I chose venues and context that I could insert dance into that was very much about social justice and trying to really open up various Black revolutionaries' consciousness to how dance, just like plays and music and poetry that the Black arts movement really focused on in the late 60s and going into the 70s, that dance could also be a part of that social political expression. And so in my early years in the Bay Area, when the Black Panthers were developing in Oakland, I used to take my choreography to their cultural center in East Oakland. And on Sundays, they used to have community showcases where artists would come and present works, mostly poets and musicians, et cetera. But I brought my dance choreography, and it was very much welcomed. And it was oftentimes reviewed in the Black Panther newspaper. So I put in the book, as one of the figures in the book, a review that actually appeared in the Black Panther newspaper. So I would say that the book really explores those two dimensions, the Africanist celebratory cultural legacy and dance by a Black choreographer, in this case myself, as a social political tool to help promote social justice, which I think is even today clearly needed.
Well, that very nicely brings me to the next question that I wanted to ask you. And in reading your memoir, it's you enter the dance world, you say, in the 1960s, and you highlight very importantly how this is, you know, the civil rights movement in the U.S., as well as all of these anti-colonial nationalist and independence movements happening in Africa, and the conversations that might be happening between these different groups, both politically and artistically. Can you speak a little bit about some of the shifts, both the changes and the continuities that you've seen in this very diverse genre of Black dance from that period to today?
Yes, well, just like the times have shifted and various social, political, and artistic and cultural organizations have come and gone, the whole way in which both the nation and I think Black people in general has constantly shifted and changed. And there have been times when there were more more of a sense of a sense of unity during the civil rights and Black power movement when I was coming of age. And then those shifts where those movements would die down and people would, as I like to think, would be lulled back to sleep and would not be as socially and politically active. And then there would be incidences that would happen and those same ideas and need for unity and collective movements for social justice would reemerge. I think today we're seeing with the Black Lives Matter movement a reemerging of what we were doing in the late 60s going into the early 70s with the Black Power movement, of course, the Civil Rights movement that changed so many of the laws for everybody in the United States, but particularly the Black arts movement and its relationship to the Black power movement. I think that we have that kind of reemerging today with the Black Lives Matter movement, but now it is a much more refined movement in the sense that it is dealing with the humanity of the situation, the morality, much more of the morality of that all human lives are important. And when we have issues that come up that really show that racism is still very prevalent in the United States with the rise of the neo-Nazi movement and, you know, just personal incidences that happen, like the recent Starbucks incident where the whole corporation is now having to go through sensitivity and racial training in order to admit and to try to shift the perceptions of its employees, et cetera, around race in America. So it's no question that the basic problem still exists, but the way in which both the Black community and other communities of color who are under similar kinds of pressure, like Latinos and Native Americans, et cetera, they are constantly shifting along with the times. I found that when I went to West Africa, that was a turning point for me because I did see the relationship of our oppression here in the United States in relationship to the post-colonial era that was happening in Africa and the lack of understanding of the relationship between the two, even though there had been revolutionaries that had really pushed for a kind of pan-Africanist consciousness. But I think that the times dictate new ways of dealing with old problems. And that is happening now. And you see artists, dancers like Camille Brown, who is today taking this whole idea of the Africanist aesthetic in her choreography and really beginning to bring up the idea of the humanity of Black people through dance. And so the same story is being told in new and different ways. Mm-hmm.
In addition to these temporal and historical shifts that you talk about in your book and in your response just now, there's also the question of geographical differences and your experiences, or shall I say your sense of adventure, took you to many different countries and many different continents. And one thing that adds another layer to your memoir is your discussion of what it was to be a Black woman in the U.S. versus Europe, given their different forms of racism, for example, or a Black woman in Africa compared to Europe. Could you expand on that a little bit more, please?
Sure. It was very important for me as a person to get outside of the United States, to explore myself both as a woman and as a Black person outside of a nation that was, you know, quite frankly, founded on difference and race itself, which is a erroneous construct to begin with. So to get outside of a place like the United States and really see myself in other contexts was very important for me, and to experience myself as an artist in those different social and political geographic places. And so in my chapter two, Dancing in Europe, you know, I really explore what it was like being a Black female in the late 60s, early 70s, and particularly in Scandinavia, but also in Spain, France, and a little bit in Holland, where I lived for a short period of time. But I found that wherever I went, there was definitely a stereotypical attitude about what a Black woman was. And so I had to deal with that in terms of trying to get people to see me as an individual. But I found that that process of being able to be seen as an individual, as opposed to a Black woman that was already etched in their minds, was much easier in Europe than it ever was in the United States. And I did not experience the kind of overt, blatant racism in Europe. For instance, when I would go to rent an apartment in Denmark, there was no racial discrimination because I was a brown-skinned woman, as it would have been in the United States, even back then in the 1970s. So it was a different kind of situation. I was looked at as an artist who had potential and that was presenting something new in Europe, and particularly in Denmark and in Scandinavia. And so the context, the place, the importance of place becomes crucial in how you develop as an artist and how you are seen. However, as you read, I definitely explore how the idea of my being an individual and being treated as an artist of worth in Europe was also made more complex by their underlying stereotypic attitude about who the Black female is. And I call that the Josephine Baker syndrome, because we were usually, until we are able to obliterate that stereotype, was seen as the exotic female sexual other. And, there's no way of getting around that. I definitely experienced that. But I also, at the same time, experienced a more of an acceptance of what I had to offer as an individual artist.
Another really interesting set of ideas that you give the reader a glimpse into is what might be described as these traces of Africanist influences on Euro-American dance traditions and culture more generally. And that seemed like such an important point in the context of your own work, but also in a broader perspective as well. Is that something that you have spent much time looking at?
Oh, yes, very much so. The foreword, which is written by Dr. Brenda Dixon Gottschall, a professor emerita of dance at Temple University, coincidence. I chose her because she is one of the foremost scholars on the influence of what she calls the Africanist performance aesthetic in American culture. She has written books like The Black Dancing Body and The Africanist Aesthetic in American Performance. So, articles for Dance Magazine on dance and race. So she is a scholar who's really explored that intersection between the art of dance and the way it has manifested racially and culturally, particularly in the United States. I talk throughout the book about how the United States could not be culturally what it is without its African American citizens. The influence of our culture through music and dance, both social dance, obviously, going all the way back to the Charleston of the 1920s, becoming one of the first dance craze, which can be traced back to the Congo. And the reason why it was called the Charleston is because it was a Congolese dance that was practiced by African Americans in Charleston, one of the main slave ports of the United States, all the way through to the 50s rock and roll era and dances like the twist and all of that. So the social dance of America, is obviously African-based. And I always tell my students that that they don't do the English minuet on Saturday nights. They actually, when they're at their parties and dancing to American pop music, they're doing as much as they can Africanist style movements with isolations of the torso and trying to do at least one or two rhythms, which are a part of the whole Africanist aesthetic. So that's one part, the influence of the Africanist aesthetic on American pop culture. But on the other side, there's great influences in concert dance as well. And Brenda Dixon Gotchel is very articulate about this, especially in terms of the postmodern dance, which oftentimes gave more into gravity and a relaxed, more of a relaxed torso than even classical modern dance did. All of those are permissions that were bodily permissions that were a part of American culture that began to seep into dance experimentation and the way that contemporary dance developed on the concert stage. And she even really articulates very specifically how even Balanchine was influenced by performing and dancing with the Nicholas Brothers, for example, and the way in which he developed the American ballet was strongly from a an Africanist perspective, coming out of Russia and then experiencing the American dance style that began to seep into what he was developing as an American ballet style. So, for sure, that theme, both with popular dance, social dance in America, and concert dance, is being influenced by the Africanist aesthetic is something that is permeating my book from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm. No, that comes out very clearly and makes for a very nuanced and multi-layered read. Finally, now that this memoir is out and available and you're touring with it, can you tell us a little bit about what you've been working on after the memoir or what plans you have? What's next?
Well, I do have plans, but it's really hard to focus on them with such an intense tour. I've been traveling throughout California, both in Northern California, where I live, and in Southern California. But just tomorrow, I'm starting to travel across country, and I'll be at Northwestern University near Chicago in Evanston with the Performance Studies Department there that's sponsoring a reading. And then going on to New York, where I will be interacting with a lot of artists, including Intozake Shange, by the way, who's joining me at Hunter College for a presentation on May 17th. And then with Jawale Willa-Jozolar, who I also talk about in the book, of the Urban Bushwomen in Brooklyn on the 21st of May. But in the back of my mind, I do have the fact that I am planning to do a sequel to this, that I ended the book in 1994 when I left my home area of the Bay Area to move to Hawaii. And it's in Hawaii where I began to work on my doctorate in American studies. And I also, at the same time, was studying hula and became, you know, actually a professional hula dancer while I was working on my doctorate. As a protege of Catherine Dunham, I cannot be in a culture that has a strong dance presence and not, you know, get involved with that. And I'm a kind of lay dance anthropologist in that way. And so I have chapters that I've already written that had to be taken out of this book because it was getting too long. And I actually have three chapters in the wings waiting to be brought out to the light of day. And I'm sure that I'll also be writing about this particular period of having published this book and now interacting with the public about it and all that's coming out in that kind of dialogue between the public around my concepts. So there will be a sequel. I don't know if it's going to be called Dancing in Blackness 2. That would be easy, but we'll see. But there'll definitely be a sequel. But after this tour, I'm definitely going to be taking a much needed rest and then beginning to look at that process, maybe trying to publish something in another couple of years. That will be a sequel bringing it up to the 21st century.
Well, Dr. Asumare, I wish you the very best for your projects and the rest of your book tour. And thank you so much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you being interested in the book and inviting me to be a part of this new Books and Dance series. I think it's very important, and I'm glad you're doing it, Sitara.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of New Books in Dance. Thank you for listening, and be sure to join me again next time.